This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
So we're at the end of our mid-Ango session, the April session, Apple Blossom session. And as you know, most usually we have a Dharma encounter during Ango, but given the pandemic and being cloistered, we're doing a Mondo instead. And so I'll say a few words and then invite comments, questions, statements, or expressions of your understanding from those of you at home and from those of you here in the resident Sangha. And as before, last month, Sean will be taking your comments, which you'll have to write in. And so it sort of inhibits a dialogue, as we would do if you were all in person. But she'll read out your questions. And it'd be nice also if you could identify yourself. So there's a person with the question that we can see you, invoke you here in the hall. And what I wanted to do is try and bring a few streams together of things that we've been studying during this Ango. This is from the Mountains and Rivers Sutra. An ancient Buddha said, "If you wish to avoid misfortune and pain, do not turn against the true Dharma wheel of the Tathagata." These words, Dogen said, should be engraved on skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. They should be engraved on interior and exterior of body and mind, engraved on the emptiness, on emptiness, and on form. They are engraved on trees and rocks, engraved on fields and villages. And I think of that in terms of taking refuge in a time of cloister, of isolation, and in which there is also division, uncertainty, sickness, fear, death, disruption of on a grand scale, and also on a very molecular cell level. And that refuge is not isolation, not in Buddhism. Solitude is not the same as loneliness. And there can be refuge and isolation. There can be solitude and loneliness. They can coexist. In fact, they often do. And that's why taking refuge and really meeting solitude is so important, so that we can find our natural place, our reclaim our original state. Dogen goes on to say, although we say that mountains belong to the country, the other translations say nation, and that's really what's being referred to here. That although we say that mountains belong to the country, the nation, actually they belong to those who love them. And when the mountains love their master, the wise and the virtuous inevitably enter the mountains. And when sages and wise ones live in the mountains, because the mountains belong to them, trees and rocks flourish and abound, and the birds and beasts take on a supernatural excellence. This is because the sages and wise ones have covered them with virtue. We should realize that the mountains actually take delight in wise ones and sages. And I wanted to look at that, this sense of belonging. That the mountains, although we say they belong to the country, the nation, the government, the property holder, actually, they belong to those who love them. And this love is the great selfless love of Kenon Bodhisattva. It's the love of intimacy. It's the love that is not possessive, that is not interested in possessiveness. And any kind of ownership that would cause harm or damage. The notion that we can own property and do whatever we want to that property because we have a contract. The old notion of marriage is a marriage contract, meaning that the wife belongs to the husband like a piece of property, like a sale of property has been transacted, is inherently violent and inevitably causes harm. That's not the love. That's not the belonging to that Dogen is speaking of. And I wonder, who do those who practice and manifest this great love, who do they belong to? The mountains belong to those who love them. Who do those who love belong to? Who those who have great compassion? This great compassion is turning towards, not away. And so we take refuge as a daily practice, as a way of turning towards and examining, not so much intellectually, but experientially, who do we belong to? What belongs to us? What does compassion have to do with this? What is the role of wisdom, of selflessness, in this kind of belonging? The precepts are practice and an expression, a living thing. This is an expression of this very same inquiry, this belonging. Belonging to and being belonged. Our metta practices, our work practice, our friendships, cleaning our home, bringing someone food. In these simple, ordinary actions that we take up as spiritual practice every day, is there love? And in that love, is there belonging? To whom? What's the nature of that belonging? This belonging, the way I understand it, it belongs to everyone. This belonging belongs to everyone. And it manifests as compassion, loving kindness in and of itself. We normally think of compassion, loving kindness needing to be directed towards something, but it is in and of itself a whole state. And it can be directed and must be directed towards others as well. It can also be directed towards non-material things like time, space, which is one of the elements in Buddhism that is being offered here on our altar, along with earth, air, fire, and water. Consciousness, too, is sometimes included as one of the essential basic elements, the irreducible elements. That, too, is up here on the altar. So why can this be so difficult to see? Why can it be so difficult to live? In the book by David Loy on Ekadharma that we've been studying, he quotes Yuval Harari, who wrote a book called Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. And I want to read his quote. "Despite the astonishing things that humans are capable of doing, we remain unsure of our goals, and we seem to be as discontented as ever. We have advanced from canoes to galleys to steamships to space shuttles, but nobody knows where we're going. We're more powerful than ever before, but have very little idea what to do with all of this power. Worse still, humans seem to be more irresponsible than ever. Self-made gods with only the laws of physics to keep us company, we are accountable to no one. We are consequently wreaking havoc on our fellow animals and on the surrounding ecosystem, seeking little more than our own comfort and amusement, yet never finding satisfaction. Is there anything more dangerous than dissatisfied and irresponsible gods who don't know what they want?" Now, we should know that he is not speaking for everyone in terms of individuals' views, ways of understanding, and ways of trying to live our lives. But I think he does speak for dominant culture, dominant consciousness, dominant societies, as evidenced through our actions. And so do we know where we're going? As practitioners, this is an essential part, to have a sense of path. Do we know this as individuals? Do we as a community? And what does that mean, to know where we're going? Are we too enchanted with how powerful we are and the pleasures of our inventions to even think about such things? And if we're not responsible to ourselves, to each other, to the earth, who are we responsible to? Who is actually responsible? What is the heart of our longing? Those of us who've been studying Wellwood's article on bypassing, he also talks about, from a psychological perspective, what he calls a basic human wound, which he says is prevalent in the modern world, that arises from not feeling sufficiently loved, belonging, as infants, as children. And so then we sort of incorporate that sense of insufficiency within ourselves. We ourselves are insufficient. We ourselves do not belong somehow. And he talks about how shocking this is to the individual, to the child, and how it sort of goes through our whole system and becomes integrated, and that we internalize that in terms of our capacity to value ourselves. And then he says that becomes the basis upon which we value others. That too becomes eternally insufficient. And he talks about this as a relational wound, a wound of the heart. And then he says, if we were a yogi practicing in a cave alone, we might not ever notice this, because it comes out between us, in the midst of our living together, in contact with each other. And so he says, it's in these relationships, of these aspects of our karma that become our impulsive consciousness, as I was talking about during the week, our samskaras, that they show up most intensely. It's in relationship with each other and with things, with the earth, with inanimate things, with how we handle objects, which is why we give attention in training to how we handle objects. Because that there itself is a relationship. And we can't divide and segregate. This is a loving relationship. I will treat you with respect and reverence and honor and in equity, and then do exactly the opposite with other things. And then finally, in going back to Ecodharma, he quotes Morris Berman in a book, The Reenchantment of the World, who says, the view of nature which predominated in the West down to the eve of the scientific revolution was that of an enchanted world, an alive world. Rocks, trees, rivers, clouds were all seen as wondrous, alive. And human beings felt at home in this environment. The universe, in short, was a place... In short, it was a place of belonging. We belong here. This is our home. We have a role here, an essential role. The earth needs us, just as it needs all the other creatures, animate and inanimate. And yet, and he says, a member of this universe was not an alienated observer, but a direct participant, an essential participant. One's identity was bound up in its destiny. Relationship, this relationship gave meaning to our lives. This consciousness involved merging with one's surroundings and bespeaks a psychic wholeness that has long since passed from this scene. Not entirely. In a certain sense, not at all. And so I want to look at this sense of belonging from the perspective of Buddhism, as it impacts, as these writers are speaking to, in our relationship with the earth, our home, our only home, and that these elements represent everything that is, everything that appears in the world is made up of these elements. We cannot survive for a second In fact, there is no way to conceive of survival, of life, even of death. Even in death, these elements are essential. And yet, this sense of alienation, of somehow not belonging, this sense of separateness, of somehow being apart from something essential, which is the heart of bodhicitta, and then plays out in all of our everyday relationships. So how do we understand, cultivate, practice this belonging, this intimacy in all of its manifestations? Because it manifests in all different ways. This is what emptiness is form, and form is emptiness is saying. How do we engage this at this particular time, in the time of our history, in the time of our lives, in the time of quarantine, towards ourselves, towards the earth, towards those we care about but can't be with right now, towards those we dislike? What does belonging mean in terms of how we belong to, given that it's based in this love? The mountains belong to those who love them. All things belong to those who love them. And those things delight in those who love them. And so this is what I'd like to explore, wherever you would like to take that. So please send us your thoughts or comments or understanding or the way you're practicing this or your questions. And those of you, we have mics so that we can all hear you and the folks at home can hear you. So just let Sarah and Mariana know if you'd like to say something.
So thank you for the question. It's a good one. The beginning of the Sangha, I decided to do a part of my practice, a ancestor altar of my own and a liturgy, and sort of hemmed and hawed about how to do this. And, you know, I have to say up front, I've had resistance to doing this, and so I was digging into that a bit and seeing what came up and getting creative to write it out. And first from my birth ancestors, and just really, I have a liturgy that I do and sort of opening that up, and then to my Dharma ancestors and a way of recognizing my belonging in this lineage and in the Buddha Dharma, spiritual teachers, all kinds, and finding a way to feel that inclusiveness. And kind of naturally emerged from that was the earth as a ancestor, a very natural one it felt. And as you were speaking, I was recognizing how very much at home I personally feel, given my experience, my karma, my personality, very at home in the earth, and protective, and as I would a parent that I love very much. And I really felt the liturgy, the dedication that we did this morning for the earth earlier in our service. It was beautiful. And my question is, knowing the imperfect relationships that we have with all these ancestors, in a sense, I mean, the earth lets me down too, you know, the same way my parents and my teachers may. How to work with that? Because I wonder, you know, is that disconnect, in a sense, that sense that we don't know our ancestors, we don't aren't called to value our ancestors, or disconnected from where we're from?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, if we think of not just Dharma practice, but our actual experience, you know, as sentient beings, we come into contact. And it's in that moment of contact that something comes alive. And too often, you know, because of our karmic consciousness, it gets veiled, it gets covered over, it gets dampened, it gets pushed away. But in that first moment of contact, it's alive. It is that love, or certainly the potential for that. It is that intimacy. And so I think we need to keep coming and bringing ourselves into contact. And our Zazen really is how we're training, we're learning how to reclaim that natural capacity to be in contact with the whole universe in its vastness, in its emptiness, and also in its particularity, right? This breath, this ancestor, this name, you know, so a name can be a way of objectifying or distancing, but it can also, when the mind turns and becomes open, it can also be a way of coming into contact with that person. That's why names in the history of humanity have had a kind of sacred role, right? They've always had meaning. And so to invoke the name, so we chant the names of the ancestors, of the women ancestors, and our lineage ancestors. And it's not just to chant names, it's really to bring the felt sense of those people. You know, Governor Cuomo, when he on his daily conferences, cites the statistics of how many people have died. Every time I've heard him say that, he always says, these are people, right? These are not numbers. And that in each person, there is a family. There are mothers and fathers and sisters and uncles and aunts and neighbors and friends and co-workers. And he invokes that whole community so that we remember, right, that what we're talking about. And so I think doing that with other things, you know, with inanimate things, and whether we invoke it in our mind or whether we go out and have direct contact, I think all of that is important. So we can both feel, come into sensory contact, but also be felt. You know, we may not think of it that way, that when we come into the presence, come into the woods or stand by a river, that we are in the presence of a living thing. And also, we are now in the presence of it, right? So we are in that moment in a more tactile relationship. And if we allow ourselves, and this again is where our mind training is so important, we will experience that. You know, we will experience that sense of being in contact with something. And I think we all know that. And so I think we have to keep both just opening the door, in a sense, we don't have to take a step at all and let it come in, but also to step forth and just keep coming into contact and really appreciating how evolving that will be for us. And then the direct, you know, the ramifications of that is in terms of when we come into contact, now what is our relationship to that? What is our sense of longing? What is our compassion? What is our responsibility? It's very different. Whenever we hurt something, we have to be distant from it. We have to be distant from it. Even if that thing we're hurting is right in front of us, we are miles away in our mind. That's the only way we can hurt something.
So this is a question from Renji. Renji says, it's been interesting for me during this pandemic, the transition of pursuing comfort and happiness to letting this go. There are so many comforts and relationships that are gone. I found comfort in my work, even though working as a nurse in the hospital could result in my death. I made end-of-life arrangements and everything. Is this belonging, this joy in serving?
Well, I would just turn that question right around and ask you, Renji, is that belonging? When you come into contact, when you're at work and you are in that place, serving those people, and that intimate contact is there for you, what do you experience? Do you experience, you know, we have these words of connection, of relationship, and so, and they're all speaking about something, and they're all, because they're language, it's language, they all sort of bring forth a sense of duality. But when you're at work, but you're not working, when you're with a patient, but they're not a patient, when you're earning a living, but you're not thinking about money, then what is it? And so I would just, for all of us, I would just examine those moments, because that's that forgetting that Master Dogen speaks about in studying the self, studying the way we study the self, and studying the self, we forget the self. And we forget the self into belonging, into that experience of intimacy. And in every moment where we're not sort of standing in that place of, I am this, I am doing this, I am doing this for you, I am doing this for this reason, then something, some gap is closing, some distance is dissolving, and something is opening, something is becoming possible that really wasn't possible before. Okay, why don't we take another? Because we talk to each other all the time.
Okay, this is Dojaku, who asks, I've been just beginning to work on grieving, talking to Hogen Sensei about this, reading and sitting with those feelings, etc. I'm beginning to explore this, so I don't really understand how to so very well. But it seems that allowing ourselves to grieve is very important to this. I think this is probably especially true for those who identify as white, to grieve the loss of our own, indigenous roots, to grieve the loss of our own indigenous roots.
Mm-hmm. Our own ancestry.
Yes.
Yeah. So I would agree, Dojaku, that grieving is really important, and it's important in my own experience for living. It's important in our allowing us to encounter death and loss and the reality of impermanence, and to encounter it deeply. And it also is this, it's synonymous with healing. The grieving is how we heal. And so there's simultaneously a letting go, a kind of an acknowledgement of loss, and there's also something that is coming to life. There is saying goodbye and saying hello at the same time. There is recognizing that something is changing its form, whether that loss is a person or our ancestry or a job or a sense of security. And so in the way that we are practicing all the time to encounter that which appears before us, when the sensations that we call grief arise, to allow ourselves to be able to hold them in this expansive inner chamber without adding meaning to them, perceiving them as something that is disturbing or shouldn't be happening or something that needs to be fixed, to worry at that moment of, you know, am I a good practitioner? You know, this is where, again, the sense of bypassing that we can think, if I'm truly liberated, then I wouldn't be having these feelings. It's not true. To be liberated is to be your whole being, to be your whole humanity, and to be liberated in that whole humanity. And so to experience that grief without any hindrance, without any self-consciousness, without any fear. And I think in the way that you've framed it in terms of what else we have lost that we might not even be aware of in our effort over the centuries to survive, to assimilate, to acclimate to, in our assumption of power, sometimes unearned power, to in our loss of power, rightful power, that we have had to make all kinds of sacrifices and have had to lose and give up all kinds of things that shouldn't have been given up, at the same time that we've held on to things that we should have given up. And so, you know, I think the more we study and come into contact with the whole, and that's why studying the ways of the earth, studying the ways of systemic oppression, bring us to all kinds of facets of ourselves and humanity and each other and our world in ways that are restorative, that are healing in their nature, that bring us into relationship, and in that then help us to see what our responsibility is. It's very difficult, certainly until it becomes more fully integrated, to be responsible. In fact, maybe it's impossible to truly be responsible if we're not in relationship. I mean, what does that even mean, to be responsible? And so sometimes it means bringing something back into view, something that has, in a sense, been hidden. You know, so these notions of within dominant cultures, dominant groups, of things that have essentially been hidden to those in those groups, so that that power that is taken from others is not, we don't have to be held accountable. We don't have to be responsible. And that's a basic crime against humanity, against the earth. But it's also a crime against ourselves. And I think that's what I hear in your words, Tojaku. So,
I want to share my being here, residency here, and being a closure here. And I just think about intimacy, that, you know, intimacy is really provide, we need the time. We need to spend our time to allow this with things. And there was a day for me, was a magic date for me. That was, I couldn't remember, maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago. That was the time that we couldn't feel, that was still in the cold and winter, and in this illness, and I couldn't quite sure that spring would come. And there was a morning, and we finished our sitting here. And I look at the window from inside, and I saw the white cherry blossomed. And I stood inside, and I just, wow. And it's like a bouquet. It's a bouquet of flowers being held by the earth and by the root of the earth, and calling me, come out, out. I'm going to show you something. So it was a raining day, so I just put my coat, raincoat, and just opened the gate or opened the door, and Shugen Roshi was, that was art practice in time. And Shugen Roshi was sitting on the stairs, and he was writing a poem. And my first reaction was, he was like a 5-year-old boy and doing his painting or something, because the whole gestures were so sincere, so cute, and I was so moved. And I was thinking, oh, in this time, he must be very busy and handle so many things in this whole earth illness, but he is writing poems. He's doing the art practice. So I continued sitting out in the rain, and I saw several of you already in the rain, wandering in the cherry blossoms. And I kept walking and walk, and towards to the gate. And I saw the sign, the wooden sign, Zen Monastery, Zen Mountain Monastery, Doshinji. And then beneath that was a stone bench. And I thought that was the first time I got this, that I saw that stone bench. So I walked towards there, and I sit down there, and just sit there and so enjoy, just listen to the car driving, and then rain just on me, on the chair. And the thought appeared to me, I've been here for almost 5 years. I passed in this gate in and out. Why this moment? Why this moment? My first time I sat on this bench. Why? Why this moment? And this something is really magic to me. I think this is the practicing. Just make this naturally opened. And we studied this point that said the Blue Mountains are constantly walking, the stone woman give birth to a child during the night, and the stone woman give a child a birth during the night. This part I couldn't get it, but I think 2 days ago I suddenly realized that I was the child, and that stone bench, just I was born by it. And I think that's the connection that just happened. And during the night, the night is the intimacy, is the time, is this intimacy that we have been together, the practicing, and allow this naturally opened, naturally happened. And I thanked all our ancestors. I thanked teachers, the founders of Daidoroshi, these founding sashin, all these sashin that practice, eight-gate practice, understand, study our mind, body, the earth. Thank you.
This question is from Kevin. A former prisoner, I've been struggling now to unravel the separation that was imposed on me all those years. That conditioning is so deep, so ingrained. How do I cross this valley that seems so vast?
That's a great question. Well, Kevin, you know, you're speaking from a place and from an experience that I have not had, not in that material sense. But the ways in which our lives imprint us, change us, influence us so deeply, and then establish these impressions within our consciousness, within our body, so that when we have new experiences that are not the same, they appear the same, that we experience them the same or in a very similar way. And it's not always, and often, or mostly, it's not a choice. It's just something that's happening to us. And so, you know, to recognize, sometimes just to recognize that although we may be having a similar reaction, something different is actually taking place. So even conceptually, we're trying to understand that and bring that in. And to just, you know, really stay present to your actual experience and try and see, you know, in this isolation now, what good things you have present for you. So if there are memories or associations that come up with that bring up deprivation or difficult memories or difficult experiences, to try and shift those by consciously being aware of the positive things that you're in the presence of right now. And sometimes if those seem hard to find or slight, we have to just dig a little deeper in terms of just recognizing that we have our breath, we have our heartbeat, we have the ability to be present in this moment, we have the place that we are, and to just work from that place of try and cultivate a place of generosity and abundance, even if it's a relative abundance, as a way to shift some of those internal streams, those internal currents, and to be patient, to really be patient, because these kinds of impressions, as every practitioner knows, if you've been practicing for any amount of time, they change, and they often change slowly. But in their changing, we are changing and our lives are changing, right? And so if we don't think in terms of, you know, absolute bondage and absolute freedom, but think of ourselves as being on this path in which there's a continual opening, you know, that when the flower opens in the spring, you know, before it opens, it's already beautiful, right? And it's already a perfect flower. And then at every stage of its opening, it continues to be beautiful, maybe even more so. But it's not more of a flower. It's the same flower.
Sara asks, how do you find belonging when serving others in a community who doesn't want you to belong? In volunteering, I sometimes serve people who explicitly show me that people like me do not belong.
Yeah. Well, to recognize that is a great injustice and really a crime against our humanity. A crime in the sense of a transgression, of an act of aggression, an act of violence, whether it's acted upon physically or emotionally, psychologically, societally, and to not underestimate the power of all those forms of harm. And to, you know, as practitioners, you know, in a sense, the ultimate path, the ultimate source of our liberation. And by ultimate, I don't mean in the sense that everything is then completed, but ultimate in the sense of going to the fundamental. And so then, because I think I hear in your question the recognition that, and the desire to within yourself shift that, recognizing that sometimes we have little power or control over another, whether that is a person or whether it's a system or society, but we do have a fair amount of control, not in the sense of controlling, but in the sense of being able to influence, impact, shift ourselves. And that's really what the Dharma is teaching us, that we're training in. And so that it's kind of like forgiveness. You know, when somebody has hurt us and they're not asking for forgiveness, they're not taking responsibility, they may not even recognize or be willing to admit that they've hurt us. And so in that sense, there's a gap, we can say. And so we could wait for them to ask for forgiveness, but that may never come. And so then the question is, can we actually forgive them without their willingness to take responsibility and ask for forgiveness? And I think that's a question that we should consider. In other words, when Trungpa Rinpoche used to say that the path of the bodhisattva is you make the first move. We're willing to make the first move. And that sometimes when others won't or can't, we can. And so then the question is, what is that move we can make? And so can we work towards belonging, towards forgiving? And in that, it may not even begin with them. It may begin with ourselves. Can we restore from that harm, from that hurt, that sense of not being seen or met or included? Can we find that wholeness, that completion, that value, that dignity within ourselves? Because in truth, no one can take it away from us, but it certainly can be harmed, injured. And so can we find that within ourselves? And I guess I'm biased, but I know of no better way than Zazen, Dharma practice, meditation, all the things that are training, that are bringing us into that sense of completion from the beginning, before we've even done anything. So it's not a result of our actions. It can't be increased. It also can't be diminished by anyone else's actions, not in its fundamental, although our felt sense of it can feel diminished. And so I think that's really a really important question, because so often we want the right resolution. We want the right resolution. The right resolution is that we both meet and we accept our mutual responsibility and we take ownership for that and we repair. And we restore that unity, that humanity, that mutual codependence. But that doesn't always happen. In fact, so often it doesn't happen. And so we need, whether we can find it that way or not, we need the stuff of that. And so I think that's where we have to look very deeply within ourselves and then in that way see how that shifts and transforms our relationship with that person. Because our being codependent means that we, at the fundamental, are dependent upon each other. We arise together. We appear. The moment that you become real to me is the moment when I see you. And so we mutually come into existence together. And so we can work from that level when the ways in which we are mutually dependent in an ordinary sense, in a societal sense, in a relational sense, is not whole, right? Is not functioning well. And in that way, we are both living out of that mutual dependence and not waiting or depending upon that other person to do something which they may not. And this is not easy. And it's a practice, which means that we may have to do it again and again and again. But I think it is a true path that we all need, because we all have such injuries, although we don't have them equally.
Okay. Belonging means that you're, for me, that at some level you're in a relationship, and to be in a relationship and to feel like you belong in that relationship is to be seen. But we grow up, especially, I think we all grow up just so fearful of being rejected and being judged that we steel ourselves, we encase ourselves in armor, and we try to morph ourselves to gain love, to gain approval, to the point that we bury so much of ourselves that we can't, and it takes so much work to become vulnerable, to shed all of that, to be seen, and therefore to feel like you truly belong. And I think there's something about nature, certainly for me, that you feel so encased by a world that just doesn't judge you. It just, in boundlessness, embraces you as belonging of it, in it. And so that's, and I think for a lot of people, there is that sense that you go to nature for an intimacy that's more accessible than with each other. There's so much work to do with each other.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for that. I was listening to a lecture by a psychologist, a trauma psychologist, who was being asked why did he think that at this time, because he'd been doing this work for decades, why did he think that at this time there was so much sort of trauma emerging within certain cultures, within certain societies. And he said he thought it was because in those very societies, the basic stability of the society was such that there was a more general sense of safety, and that people felt like they could, in a sense, relax on that deeper level and allow themselves to begin to feel what they had, what was inside of them and had been inside of them perhaps for generations. And I really thought about that, you know, in terms of a community, a monastery, a sangha, and that as we, you know, as we train intensively and also, you know, sort of in a way that's lively, you know, which means that we are challenged in different moments so that we can see beyond our self-created limitations, which brings some anxiety with it, right? And trepidation and lack of trust and so on, and a fear of rejection. And it sort of invokes a lot of those things that can be very, you know, inculcated from not being seen, not being valued, and so on. And so the importance of, you know, the sort of striving to create an atmosphere that is fundamentally feeling safe and trusting, which means we have to see each other, we have to regard each other, we have to have good, right relationships with each other, so that there is that sense of trust and relaxing at a deeper level, so that then we can begin to trust in a relational way. You know, trust, I think, is something that's so deep within us, and that we're born, I think, trusting. I mean, think of babies and infants, you know, they're so completely dependent for everything that they have to trust. And they're sort of born as part of the wonder of children and infants, is that sort of just abundance of trust. And so it's, I feel like that's our basic impulse. But then when it's not met or not met well, or it's injured or really violated, it's, you know, we're so self-protective because we don't want that kind of hurt again. And that's a basic survival impulse. It's an intelligent impulse in a sense, but it gets broadcast. And so that it's a slow process of rebuilding that trust. I mean, we can do it, but it has to slowly be rebuilt. And it can only rebuild, I think, by having trusting experiences, both internally with ourselves, where we are learning to trust ourselves. And then we're also, that's being strengthened by having trusting relationships. And that's where we really need to learn how to do that and be responsible to each other for that. And that's, again, is why it's so important to understand our systemic forms of, and sort of institutionalized forms of not trusting, you know, and not honoring that trust in each other. Because that means when we come into an encounter with each other, there is an inequity, right? For me as a white man, coming into contact with a person of color or a woman means there is societally an inequity of power and a history, a legacy, right, of violence and distrust and disrespect and oppression. And even whether it's present or not in our minds, it's in us. And so if we're not sensitive to that, then we both act out of our own sort of karmic entanglement, which can be perpetuating those forms, and also not see how our unintended or our good intentions can have unintended, hurtful consequences. And so that's why we have to, you know, really study on all of these levels, you know, at these very deep, ultimate, you know, inward-turning levels, and then also educating ourselves about the world we live in and that has been given to us. Okay, Sean.
Diana Strablow asks, how does the earth and the rest of nature, the web of life on this planet, need us, humans? Isn't it obvious that the rest would be better off without us?
Well, it certainly seems like that. But I think that's, we're looking at it, we're looking at the consequences of our actions, which are based in this alienation. And we're looking at it from the same mind. We're looking at it from that mind of alienation. And so even though it's well-intended, right, it's coming from a place of love and seeing the harm that's been done and wanting to heal that and thinking the only way we can do that is if we just are absent, right? I am so irresponsible, I cannot be trusted, so the only way to actually heal is if I just am no longer part of your life. But I think that's not true. And the actual answer to that question, I don't know. I don't know how the earth needs us. But, and maybe that's because I too am both still embedded in that alienated view and in the that raw feeling of pain that I feel responsible for having caused. But it's much easier when I think of it in terms of other beings. How does the earth need trees? How does the earth need all of its wild creatures? How does the earth need rivers and oceans? I mean, it's kind of like saying, well, then what are we talking about when we talk about the earth? Because when we say, how does the earth need rivers, it's as though the rivers aren't the earth, right? And isn't that just bringing us back to that sense of alienation? So if we can see that with all the other creatures of the earth as earth itself, because if they're not the earth, then what is the earth? At what point, what can we eliminate as not the earth, and then what's left? Right? If it's not soil, if it's not rocks, if it's not, what's left? Right? We would just keep chiseling down to its inner core, right, until there was nothing left. And I had never even really thought about it that way. But when I think about it that way, that really helps me. So thank you for that question. It helps me to see how we are needed, that the difficulty of being able to see that is because I'm so embedded, you know, still in that sense of I do not belong here. Right? How did I come to believe that? How have we come to believe that? Right? It doesn't just happen. You know, it wasn't that long ago, these peoples who have this understanding and still do, and many people do, I think all of us have, you know, are kissed by the earth and that understanding in moments of that bare wonder when we come into contact with the earth. But how did we become so estranged from that? And is that fundamentally different from the estrangement we experience that is the source of our bodhicitta? I don't think so. So, maybe one more.
Alec Micklejohn writes, "It occurred to me that I don't understand what it means or in what way do I belong to myself."
Mm-hmm. I pray you will practice and become more and more clear to that question, Alec. And I say with confidence that if you do practice with sincerity, you will answer that question, as each of us needs to. You know, the consequences of not really knowing this is our pain and misfortune. You know, Buddhism is such an evidence-based tradition. Mystical in the sense that its fundamental basis can't be measured or known, and that its realization is that direct contact with what cannot be known, and that is our evidence, right? And that's the wonder of practice and the Buddha Dharma. But I think coming into that sense of belonging, I mean, I really think if you really think about, if each of us thinks about what, you know, if you're still very much in it, or if you go sort of back to that experience, if I think back to, you know, who I was, where I was, what the way I was feeling, the way I was experiencing my life, you know, before I came here, before I even encountered the Dharma, you know, in that inner turmoil, that inner confusion, that inner kind of madness, that was not crazy mad, but was mad with wanting something so deeply and having the sense that something was possible, and yet not knowing where to go, what it was, how to proceed. Did anyone even know? And I think if we go back to that and sort of really investigate just the state of that time within us, then we'll experience a sense of both disenchantment as well as a disbelonging, that somehow we are not in contact with something. And there is something that we can be in contact with. Right? And what the Buddha realized is that which we come into contact with, which we call the self of self and other, is fundamentally unfindable, ungraspable, and that's our liberation. Because now that belonging is unconfined, right? It doesn't belong anywhere, which is just another way of saying it belongs everywhere. So I wanted to end with a poem of Rumi, the great mystic poet. "Come, come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving, it doesn't matter. Ours is not a caravan of despair. Come. Come, even if you have broken your vows 1,000 times. Come, yet again, come, come. Even if you have broken your vows 1,000 times, even if you have been hurt 1,000 times, even if you have hurt something or someone 1,000 times, even if you have lost your way, even if you have given up 1,000 times, ours is not a caravan of despair. These are not tears of despair. Come. Yet again, come, come. This is the Buddha path. And the Buddha path is nothing other than our nature. Our nature is not a caravan of despair. It is a joyful riot on a spring morning. and recognizing that within a time of despair and within our own grief is not a small thing, but it's not a distant thing either. So thank you, everyone, for being with us this morning. Thank you, everyone. And may we continue our practice together and really appreciate and practice appreciation. You know, spring is such a time to cherish life, to cherish life. And the earth is continually calling us to that.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.